thank you very much for coming. I'm here with John Matonis, who in the Bitcoin world, everybody knows him. In the FT world, maybe not so much. So I will briefly introduce him as someone who has been, who has played a pivotal role, I would argue, in popularizing Bitcoin and in sort of preaching the cause of Bitcoin and generally getting everyone to know about it. He's here, however, because he recently became kind of front page news in a strange way, because he was closely involved in trying to identify who Satoshi Nakamoto is, the pseudonymous founder of Bitcoin itself. But before we get to that, I actually wanted to talk to John more about some of the stuff that we here in the FT and outside of the kind of Bitcoin bubble, I would argue, don't necessarily know about so much, which is the roots of this whole phenomenon. And I'm not talking about the foundation myth of Satoshi. I'm talking about where this stuff emerged from. And there's been a lot of books written about Bitcoin, but they don't really get to the core point here, which is this so-called cypherpunk movement. So let's start off very quickly, not quickly, very, take your time, sorry. In the initial phase, let's start off with John. How did you come into this entire weird world of Bitcoin and of cypherpunks? When did you, you've told me before, you're not a cypherpunk, but you were very closely sort of involved in that area. So tell us a little bit how you perceive that entire movement.
Sure, sure. It's interesting that you bring up Bitcoin, because Bitcoin does owes a lot of its roots to the cypherpunk movement. And people at FT tell me that you're not so much of a Bitcoin fan, but I brought you a Bitcoin today so that now you can have one for yourself.
Okay, now I have to declare my interest.
It's actually just a doubloon, so don't worry about it.
thank you, John.
Myself and cypherpunks is an interesting story, because I actually started that journey at RSA Data Security when they were starting to spin out a company called Digital Certificates International. Later, that company became VeriSign. And there were a group of about 10 or 12 people that spun that group out of RSA Data Security. VeriSign originally was responsible for the issuing the digital certificates that was able to jumpstart SSL in the early days with the SSL protocol from Netscape with Tahir El-Gamal and others. And it was that certificate and that partnership between Netscape and VeriSign and RSA that actually created SSL, for better or worse. I mean, SSL has a lot of problems. The entire internet security structure has a lot of problems, and the main reason that it has a problem is because the certificate revocation list never really followed through from the original vision. So now you have secure internet connections we're all familiar with. We see the padlock when we're using the web and online banking, but you know those certificates now can essentially come from anyone. And the root keys have been deployed in many different browsers. There's attempts to remedy this, and we're starting to see that emerge now. But that was my introduction to it. Eventually, leading after VeriSign, I also worked with the people at Hushmail. And Hushmail is a end-to-end encrypted email solution operating today in Vancouver, but originally operated out of Ireland because it had to have non-US developers operating outside of the US. And that's basically my inroads to the cypherpunk movement.
So tell us a little bit, like literally, because we're newbies, we don't know this weird world. What's the philosophy about?
Well, you can think of the word cypherpunk as a strange combination of cyberpunk with C-Y-B-E-R, and then the word cypher merging together as cypherpunk. There's several books written about cypherpunks and the internet and privacy. The main goal is that to use cryptography to protect your privacy and advance your interests of privacy. The group was formally launched by three individuals, Tim May, Eric Hughes and John Gilmore. John Gilmore eventually became or was one of the early employees of Sun Microsystems, one of the founders of EFF. And this was in 1992. So the cypherpunks launched in 1992, basically on a mailing list with, you know, 100 to 500 subscribers on a mailing list to write code. Cypherpunks write code. And to be a cypherpunk in that early group, you essentially were a developer. It's later become a broader term to include a larger group of self-defined individuals that are advancing privacy protocols through the use of cryptography, specifically public key cryptography.
But tell us maybe a little bit more about what was their, why were they doing this? What were they concerned about? What was the agenda really here?
Yeah, that's great reference point, because the technical roots, the technical heritage leading up to 1992 was essentially the work of David Chaum in the late 80s, the mid to late 80s. David Chaum was a developer mathematician from the Netherlands, responsible for several electronic money privacy protocols, blind signatures, and also the founder of DigiCash. Now, this is a very important part of the history, because with DigiCash, you were essentially setting up anonymous electronic money, very much a precursor to the ideas of Bitcoin, but you had the one limitation of a centralized issuer. So in the DigiCash system, you always had to go and rely on a centralized mint to reissue your DigiCash tokens. And this centralized structure became one of its weak points. And just like BitTorrent was a reaction to the crackdown on Napster, you could almost say that Bitcoin was a reaction to the crackdown on centralized money issuers, centralized digital money issuers. So the genesis of the cypherpunk movement, and people have built upon this, the cypherpunks today are really people in their 50s or 60s. So, a much older group, and even a much older group than the creators of Bitcoin, in my opinion. So a reaction to that...
Sorry.
A reaction to that centralized issuing is eventually what led to Bitcoin and the protocols used in Bitcoin. Some of the protocols used in Bitcoin came from well-known cypherpunks like Hal Finney and Adam Back.
So there's, I would argue, as an outsider completely, that there is this romanticized sort of perspective of it all within the Bitcoin community, especially that, you know, there was a perception that Bitcoin would have come from this movement because there was this key concern about privacy, and they were kind of fighting for people's privacy. Is that fair? Is that a fair... statement by
Well,
you.
It's more than just it is. It's based around privacy, but anonymous email, digital signatures, and electronic money were basically the core functions.
So let's now pivot, as they do in Techland. Is someone called Craig Wright from that sort of heritage?
Craig Wright,
for those who do not know, has been. Recently, very closely linked with the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto. In fact, John Matonis came out to endorse him as the likely creator of Bitcoin. We'll get into the details of that now, but let's start with, does Craig Wright, as you met him and knew him, did he come from that school?
I do know Craig Wright personally. He lives here in London for the moment. And as Isabella knows, since she broke the story on it, there was originally going to be something at the London School of Economics regarding that, which turned into a different type of an announcement. Craig is much younger than what the 1980, 1990 cypherpunks would be like. And he built upon that work. So of course he could be a self-described cypherpunk, but he would not be in that same original group. So think of it the way you would think of Moxie Marlinspike, who developed a Signal, the mobile app for secure phone messaging and secure voice. He built upon that work. Now, Bitcoin was launched, the white paper was launched on a cryptographer's mailing list where these people were, and Hal Finney was one of the very first people to download the Bitcoin, the original Bitcoin core protocol, and start playing around with it. So obviously, the work that Hal contributed back, he gets credit for being an early developer of Bitcoin.
So perhaps best to expand this as follows. So what was your experience with this whole Craig situation? I mean, tell us, the London Review of Books recently published a story by Andrew O'Hagan, and it told a very long, like, long-winded, I would say 35,000 words worth of insights into this entire, like, proof of identity episode with Craig. Tell us your involvement, how you came across Craig in the beginning, and what you still think today with respect to everything that went on.
Right. That's a big question, but...
Yeah, I thought I'd put it... I'd let you say it in your own words, because I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I am not trying to be, and I never wanted to be, a Bitcoin disciple, or a disciple of Craig Wright, a disciple of Satoshi. But with transitive trust, you're in this situation. And so that's where I find myself. There are certain aspects that I have had access to, certain evidence that I've had access to that the general public has not had access to, so I'm comfortable with my statements. I haven't changed anything around my blog post. I haven't done any retractions on that. And Craig himself will also, even though he's comes across as a little strange on camera, he never himself wanted to be outed either. And he's very humble in terms of the credit for Bitcoin. If you notice in some of his public discussions, as well as the private discussions that he's had with me, he credits people like Dave Kleinman as a partner, maybe for reviewing the white paper, not so much on the coding side. He credits people like Gavin Andreessen and Mike Hearn. So he recognizes it as a shared development, and he is very humble about it. So the article that came out, 35,000 words in the London Review of Books, I knew Andrew O'Hagan because he had been interviewing players in this going back almost a year, and I spent quite a bit of time with him during the London proof sessions, and I don't think there's any inaccuracies in that article. And I had very good experience with Andrew.
Did you think it was weird that there was so much sort of media management of the whole thing? Did that strike you as in any way strange, or is that normal in the Bitcoin world? I'm just curious.
Well, it would have been strange if it was Craig Wright wanting to do it on his own as Satoshi, but what the article from Andrew O'Hagan reveals is that it was actually corporate interests that were behind Craig Wright that were actually stage managing this, and it had a lot more to do at a corporate level, enterprise-wide, than it did with just one individual coming out as Satoshi. So the stage management was really, when you look at it in that context, it doesn't seem that strange, because it was only one component of a broader strategy that hasn't even been revealed yet.
Fair enough, but some might say that if he wanted, I'm playing devil's advocate at this point, some might say that if he just wanted to prove his identity, he could have done it very simply and without a lot of the, even from a corporate, with the corporate interests, he could have just done it without the big media hoopla.
Right, but he essentially never really wanted to reveal his identity, so he had been trying to avoid that at all steps along the process. And it's also fair to say that the relationship that Craig had with this company, Encrypt, no longer exists. I mean, the company is still there, but Craig's involvement is no longer relevant. He's severed ties with them because this component was not able to complete the corporate strategy for them.
So recently, Reuters, I believe, reported that there have been a lot of patents filed by Craig, but in the form of this company, I presume. Just explain to me this logically, because I'm not in the tech space at all, and I seem to have I have trouble understanding how a technology which is supposed to be open source and open protocol with, you know, available for the masses, is now being patented by someone like Satoshi, because that seems to strike me as a monetization tool. And like you and I have discussed before, that really the corporate interests that are trying to monetize it are the private banks now by way of the blockchain. So is this about protection for Bitcoin, or how do you square that?
How do you square that circle? Exactly. Well, personally, I am against software patents. I mean, they reduce innovation in the space. And when people say that they're taking out things for defensive reasons, it's really in the eye of the beholder whether they're holding it for a defensive patent. So you really have to dig behind the covers and see, is this really for defensive purposes? The intellectual property that was created by Craig Wright was turned over to the enterprise, to the corporation. So it's no longer technically owned by Craig. Now, on the decision of what to open source versus what not to open source, that's going to be a strategic decision in terms of which open protocols will benefit the spread and proliferation of the new technology that's behind it. I mean, we're talking about a portfolio of between 400 and 700 patents that aren't even fully completed yet. And we haven't heard the last of this company, because the overall plan is to build an enterprise that is effectively a counterbalance to something like Blockstream. And Blockstream in the market today is where a majority of the Bitcoin core developers sit in Canada. It's Austin, one of Austin Hill's latest company. So we haven't heard the end of this, and if it's successful, it will go well beyond just being a Bitcoin blockchain company. It has the potential to be an enterprise finance, healthcare, everything kind of company on the level of something like Oracle or Microsoft.
But there is a very explicit sort of ownership sort of attempt here, isn't there? Like, in terms of, it doesn't belong to the people anymore if that happens.
No, there's an attempt. There's obviously an attempt to profit from it. That doesn't necessarily come directly from Craig, though. It has to do with the revenue model that you select around pushing the code out into the business world. Are you going to? I don't think a software license fee is appropriate. I think that you could have transaction fees. You could also have certain protocols that you release for free to enable the other side of what you're trying to develop. I'll give you an example on that, because with what we've seen lately with smart contracts and Ethereum, it's entirely possible through changes in the Bitcoin scripting language, using multi-signature technology, to use Bitcoin for a good portion of what Ethereum was attempting to do. And there's companies that are developing this technology, such as Rootstock Labs. If we can get to that point, then we start to see the Bitcoin protocol as a protocol battle or a protocol war, where Ethereum, things like Ethereum and Bitcoin are definitely competitors, because they're fighting for who is going to build that global security protocol infrastructure. And the successful investors in this space are going to be the ones that see the Bitcoin protocol in the way that you look at TCP/IP or the way that you look at any other protocols that have a first mover advantage that benefit from the network effect. And this is what gets the VC community so excited about Bitcoin, is they see it as the next TCP/IP, voice over IP. And the work that has been coming from these patents are the building blocks around that that can push that out to the entire world. But there's nothing at all decided on how one company can profit from it. you have to balance that against what you're releasing in open source.
So it seems to me that there's this big claim. I mean, there's a lot to profit from if you can launch a legitimate claim to being Satoshi in that case. Why do you think so much of the community haven't bought the story and still to this day are very skeptical? I mean, is this a vested interest thing now? Or what's your interpretation of why he was effectively rejected, I would argue?
Well, I think it's what you said up front, very specifically. It's the there was no demonstration made to the public at large. Things that Gavin witnessed, things that I witnessed, were on an individual level. So there were nothing that we could repeat. And by the way, Gavin has...
Is that not somewhat ironic?
But Gavin has not retracted his claims on that either.
Right, okay.
And it's not ironic if
so
you,
we have to trust you.
You do have to trust me, but I'm not trying to be a disciple.
No, fair enough. Now, I want to invite... Is it okay to invite some questions from the audience? Are you okay with that, or...?
Yeah, I am okay with that. Okay. But before you do, I wanted mm-hmm. to say one additional thing.
Please
because
do.
I didn't finish answering your question about why people are skeptical. If you notice, a lot of the skepticism, especially the vitriol, has come from the people in the Bitcoin community that have the most to lose by this Satoshi coming out. Specifically, people like Gregory Maxwell at Blockstream. They won't be seen in the same light if the real original Satoshi is out. And it'll be an effective counterweight to this mantle of authority that they've been claiming. So you have to really look at the agenda of the people who are trying to dispute this, with the evidence or not.
Good point. Are there any questions in the audience? Hands up. That chap there with the beard seems very keen. Is there a mic? Is a mic coming?
No Satoshi questions.
No Satoshi questions. I will filter these questions.
Hi.
If they're inappropriate, I will intervene.
Okay. Izzy, this is a question you've asked on Alphaville a couple of times that I found...
Can't hear you very well.
I can't hear.
This is a question, Izzy, that you've asked on Alphaville a couple of times that I think is sort of quite pertinent for commercialization of Bitcoin, but who maintains the ledger for all of these big bank financial applications for the... distributed blockchain, and why do they do that, and why do people trust them with that ledger?
Was the question, can you repeat the question?
I think he said who maintains the ledger for these distributed blockchains, but I didn't catch the last point. Could you just...
So who maintains the ledger of these new revolutionary technologies, and why do end users end up trusting them more than the existing kind of private
right.
ledger system?
Well, so how is it different to the current system in the long run?
Well, if you're talking about the private permissioned closed blockchains, then there isn't much of a difference to the current system. But that's different from a permissionless open blockchain such as Bitcoin. There's a proof of work consensus that is done, and the blocks that are built upon that are aggregate versions. You're building upon history, so it's an open protocol where it's permissionless as opposed to the closed permissioned protocols of the blockchains that you're talking about. Those aren't even, they can be thought of as centralized in a much easier way. Does that answer your question?
I mean, I'd like to just jump in with a question. Who's got the next question? Okay, there's a question right up front in the white, but I'm going to quickly jump in with my question as the mic is going there. John, because you and I, we've developed a funny relationship in so much as your enemy's enemy is your friend, and I'm one of the few people who's critical of Bitcoin, but I'm also quite critical of the private blockchain movements. And I was just wondering, could you tell us why you are so adamant that the alternative private ledgers systems that are being, or the distributed multi-ledger private, sometimes public, but over many geographies, I don't know, whatever the buzzword is at the moment, what do you critique about them?
Well, it boils down to the word permission, because it creates a gatekeeper. At some point. So if you're creating a gatekeeper on who's deciding the permissioning, then you have an opportunity for abuse, and you have an opportunity for censorship. As opposed to a public blockchain, transactions on a private blockchain can be blocked, they can be revoked, they can be modified. And unfortunately, what we're seeing now in the financial world is the development of a lot of consortiums directed at the permissioned private blockchain world. And you've referred to it in your articles even. I mean, this is creating a mini cartel, and the participants are largely the people from the institutions from the legacy world. But I've even seen instances with some of these consortiums that valid players are being blocked from even participating in the consortium. So how can you have an open consortium if you're blocking who's even in the consortium? I mean, you're not even a full-blown cartel yet.
I tend to agree. So the question at the front.
It took 200 years for America to hit the debt ceiling showdown and for essentially financial governance in the United States to be seen as slightly crap. In Bitcoin, it's been around for less than a decade, and yet it's already got incredibly crippling governance issues, largely related to the block size. How is that not existentially damning for the currency and its governance?
Is history repeating itself, but much more quickly?
Well, I think you're pointing to the success of Bitcoin in a short period of time, a seven-year span. It's been the most successful digital currency ever with the largest market cap. The scalability issues will be solved. I definitely don't think that Bitcoin's dead. I definitely don't think that Bitcoin's going away. And just like we scaled the early internet, the scaling process will be gradual. It won't happen all at once. It won't happen on one day where you flip a switch. Now, on the existential part of your question, I think you were talking about, correct me, but I think you were talking about trusting Bitcoin in the same way that you trust fiat?
No, not at all. No, it was far more the fact that when those scaling issues hit, the governance of Bitcoin fell apart, and we came into 2016 with incredibly nasty arguments on all sides, which didn't lead to action in any effective way.
No, I understand what you're saying now. There is effectively no government of Bitcoin. So, I mean, that's a misnomer to think that there's a government of Bitcoin.
Unlike Ethereum.
Pardon?
No government, I think he said.
Governance.
Oh, yeah, or government, okay, or even governance. But it performed exactly as designed. And I know that's taking a shortcut answer, but the ultimate governance of Bitcoin is played out through software propagation wars. If you want to change the Bitcoin Core protocol, you have to change it through software propagation. And Bitcoin was designed to be very inherently difficult to change that way. It's possible. It's not impossible, but it's a overwhelming majority of change to be able to affect something like that. And that was as designed. I don't see it as a governance problem. I see it as a successful warding off of an attack.
So there you go. Sadly, we've run out of time, but I'm sure maybe John is still around as we get off. But quickly, quick fire, the halving, is what's going to happen? Like, is it going to be good or bad?
It's going to be short-term bad for miners, but it's going to be ultimately good for the price.
Like Brexit.
Yeah, and I don't think we'll see any real major change in the hash rate computational power.
And you are still committed to your declaration that Craig Wright is Satoshi, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much, John. It's been really great having you here explaining your point of view on all this.
Thank you
so much. Thank you for the book.
I have.